Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh and Beck Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh and Beck Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome to Legal Talk. Thank you so much for being with us today. We are going to be picking up from our last show with attorney Kevin Flesh, brought to you by Flesh and Beck Law. Their number 303-806-8886. And last week, if you were with us or if you missed it, I will inform you what we were discussing. We were talking kind of about the steps in the criminal law process, and Kevin was going through a lot of different terms that most of us are familiar with. Hopefully just by TV, when you get arrested and bail, arraignment, preliminary hearings, and we ran out of time to get into the grand jury proceedings and what that's all about. So first of all, we'll welcome Kevin Flesh back. How are you?
Thanks. I'm good.
Good.
Interesting stuff.
Man, it is. You know, because, again, most of us just see all these things on TV and just hear all these different terms, but really don't have a clear understanding of, you know, when a grand jury gets involved and how many people that is, you know, is it like a regular jury number and all that kind of thing. So kind of tell us when a grand jury gets involved.
Yeah, so grand juries are impaneled. Generally, there's both state grand juries in each jurisdiction of the state. So each judicial district will have a grand jury that they can impanel. And the prosecutors there, the district attorneys, are the ones that have the ability to put together a group of people from the community. It's generally 12 people, and it's generally a year-long commitment. And so that particular grand jury, so let's say in Denver, Denver has a pretty active grand jury system. So the prosecutor there has a grand jury that meets periodically, and they present, the idea is with a grand jury, is what the grand jury does is it's presented evidence from the prosecutor. The prosecutor provides their best evidence and explains what they want the grand jury to decide, whether or not, most of the time it's crimes, what the community members think are crimes, mm-hmm. after hearing particular pieces of evidence. And generally it's witness testimony, or it might be documents, but it's evidence that's not refuted or rebutted. Remember, this is just the prosecutor that's in the room with these individuals. It's a secret proceeding. They cannot talk about any of it while it's going on. A lot of times you'll hear, recently you heard about the grand jury that indicted the CFO of Trump's organization.
Right, right.
For example, there is a good example of a grand jury that I think has worked a long period of time, being presented with a lot of evidence that finally indicted someone over what seems to be perks of a position and potential tax evasion. My understanding in that particular case is that prosecutor has had it out for Trump forever and is looked for has looked for reasons and spent millions of dollars and had a task force trying to indict Trump himself, but he just doesn't have the evidence, because in these situations, the grand jury, you know, there's the old saying that you can indict a ham sandwich through a grand jury process. But I don't think that's necessarily true. It's certainly not tested evidence in the sense that you'd have the person that's being accused of the crime there refuting things or providing their spin on the evidence or cross-examination. It's always the best evidence that the prosecution thinks they have to make the case. A lot of times, though, grand juries are answering questions that the prosecutor just aren't really sure about. They're not sure if they're really crimes or not, or if they have enough evidence to indict someone. Sometimes you'll see grand juries be impaneled for murder cases where, let's say, the prosecution doesn't have a body, and they'll provide evidence to the grand jury to determine whether or not there's probable cause to bring a charge of murder. That's when a lot of times you'll see it. I've actually been involved in grand jurors on a number of occasions over the last 25 years. Most of them, it was with clients that were witnesses to something or potentially individuals who were going to be indicted. And most of the time, they wouldn't allow the lawyers in the room with the individual testifying. So private, secure, really sort of an unusual situation in our legal system, in the sense that it is not, so you go in and have to testify, but you can't talk about it. You don't know what it's
ever.
Ever. Yeah, basically.
Really?
Yeah. And so, but I have been lately, within the last 5 or 10 years, I've had a number of cases where my clients were the potential parties that were going to be indicted, and I've gotten the prosecutors to allow me in the room to potentially make objections and to also protect my client from their Fifth Amendment right to be free of answering questions that may incriminate them. And so the only purpose I was in the room for was for that purpose, because they had a constitutional right to have someone advocating for them. And in those cases, I had to agree with the judge that it was secret, that I wouldn't raise the issue, that I would never tell anyone about it, and that I wouldn't have any way of ever disclosing it. But it's a super interesting process, because you're basically show up like you would in a regular trial, except there's nobody there for the defense. It's just the prosecutor providing information to the grand jurors. And then the grand jurors can give feedback and see potentially what else the prosecutor may have for evidence. And it's a real, it can be a real interactive process at times, depending upon how they're running the grand jury process.
So this grand jury, they may hear a lot of different cases.
Oh, they'll most likely hear all kinds of different cases. Yep. Wow. Or they'll hear one case and they'll just deal with that. It's the same thing with, there's federal grand jurors. So, you know, downtown Denver, where the main federal courthouse is, they'll have grand jurors impaneled there, or they may have them impaneled on the Western Slope, where they're taking testimony to make some decisions about particular instances of conduct and whether there's crimes that have been committed.
Wow.
And it's the idea with it is those situations where the prosecutors really aren't sure whether they have a criminal case, whether they should be proceeding with it, and you get the sense from the community what they think and what those individuals believe. Because generally speaking, for an indictment to happen, you've got to have a unanimous agreement with them on whether or not the charges can go forward.
Wow.
And so the idea now, as a defendant, once the indictment occurs and you've been taken in custody, you bond out, all the things we've talked about, you still may be entitled to have a court review those transcripts and make its own determination relating to probable cause. So that's sort of the preliminary hearing stage. But generally speaking, it's not a situation where you have a hearing about it. The court just reviews those transcripts, and you get to review those transcripts. Because once the indictment is opened, then that information is privy to the defendant so that they know what they're fighting, so that they have an idea of what it is that the evidence that's against them. And that's part of the discovery, or the evidence that the prosecution has that they're going to use against you in the main part of the proceedings. That'll all be public at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Legal Talk, brought to you by the law firm of Flesh and Beck Law. Their number 303-806-8886. The website is fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH lawfirm.com. And it's always a free consult with Kevin. So if you just call and mention you heard him here on Legal Talk, he will be glad to help you. All right, and again, we're just going through some terms that we commonly hear. So let's talk about, you know, motions. You always hear these, you know, motions made. We'll make a motion of this, make a motion of that. And then, so are there trial motions or pre-trial motions? Are there a couple of different categories of motions when in trial?
Yeah, so there's probably three categories of motions. One would be motions for discovery, preliminary trial motions, preliminary hearing, a demand for preliminary hearing. You know, you're asking to get all the evidence from the DA. You've got to request that, and that's a motion. You're basically asking the court to make certain orders relating to the case so that you know how the case is going to proceed. Those motions are generally done pretty early on in the case so that you get an idea of how the court handles certain issues relating to discovery and investigation, what things you're going to be able to do in the way of pretrial issues and discovery, so that you have a good sense of where you're going to go with developing the facts of the case. The second portion of the motions practice in a criminal case is after you've had the arraignment, You've pled not guilty. You've set the matter for jury trial. If it's a misdemeanor case, you have a jury of six. If it's a felony case, you have a jury of 12. And in the event that you're in a municipal court, for example, you can still many times request a jury. You just have to pay a jury fee of $25. And then you get to determine what number of jurors you want, which is sort of interesting in municipal court, because you can decide whether you want anywhere from three to six jurors. So maybe you want three or four or five or six. I always think six is good, because the more people you have in the room in a criminal case to make a decision about guilt,
sure,
that's more minds the prosecution has to prove, because everybody has to unanimously agree to a guilty verdict. And if they can't, then the verdict should be unanimously not guilty. But those are the three areas that you normally get jury trials in the state, and how many jurors you get. So you've made a request for a jury trial, and you've now got a trial date. The court almost always sets a motions hearing date, and the motions hearing date is a date in which you're dealing with evidentiary issues that you're going to have to deal with at trial. And a lot of times the issues are maybe a motion to suppress evidence, motion for maybe there's an irregularity in the way that the police handled a DUI stop, and mm-hmm. so you're fighting that issue, or maybe that you don't think that in a DUI stop they had a reasonable suspicion for pulling you over. So maybe you believe that in your particular case they didn't have a legal right to pull you over because you hadn't done anything illegal.
Right.
And if that's the case and they don't have the right, because police officers just can't pull you over for no reason, if you can prove that they didn't have a legal right to do that, then the case, the evidence that they gained from that stop would be suppressed. And if they suppress all of that evidence, the prosecution has no evidence to pursue the DUI charge, for example. Mm-hmm. You also have motions that you may be having issues relating to, let's say in a sex assault case, you may have it may be between a boyfriend and girlfriend, for example. And so you have issues relating to what situations can you talk about in the way of, let's say in a sex assault case, it's the issue of consent, whether the one party consented to the sexual act or not. And you have this boyfriend and girlfriend that had consensual sex hundreds of times before that. But this one time she says, no, it wasn't consensual. And you have an issue of, well, what can we talk about with the prior to suggest that there was consent in this case? And that is covered by the rape shield law, for example. So you've got the judge balancing the alleged victim's right not to be basically on trial for the past sexual exploits that she may have had with the person, at the same time balancing the defendant's right to talk about, well, I believe that it was consensual in this case because of the things that we did in the past. And so you have to deal with that before you get to a jury trial. And so those sorts of motions, you have evidentiary hearings about what that evidence would look like, and then the court makes a value decision about whether or not that evidence is important, relevant, and if its relevance is more important than maybe the unfair prejudice to the mm-hmm. at fault to the alleged victim. And so those are the sorts of issues that you've got to deal with prior to trial, and those are normally handled in a motions hearing.
Okay.
The third section of motions are generally, they're motions in limine. They're issues that you may have to take up just before a jury trial to say maybe the prosecution didn't give us this evidence in time, so that evidence should be excluded from the trial. Or in the case of a civil case where you have a car accident where one person is cited for a traffic offense and the other person isn't, that, and you're saying the person that is cited, the defense is always trying to keep that citation out of the civil case because it doesn't really matter what happened in the criminal context, because the jury has to make a determination of liability, not okay. criminal actions. So those are the sorts of things that you talk about as you get closer to a jury trial, that the court makes, again, rulings so that you know the rules of the road when you get into trial and you know what evidence you can talk about and what evidence you can't.
Right.
Because there are lots of cases where you can't talk about probably the thing that's the most important to the jury. Let's say in a civil case, most jurors want to know what the insurance limits are for the person that's at fault, because that'll help them determine what the appropriate amount of damages are. Well, in Colorado, you can't talk about insurance, and you can't talk about insurance limits. So you always have motions in limine about you can't bring that up because that'll taint the juror's view of what the case may be worth. You know, I'll give you an example. I had a case down in Pueblo. The jurors it was clear liability. My client was very badly injured. A 16-year-old girl testified. She caused the accident. The jurors could tell, and they really liked her, and they could tell that it was a significant case. They didn't want to give a verdict that would forever hurt the 16-year-old girl. So their first question while they were deliberating was, how much are the insurance limits? Right out of the gate. Because they knew that they were gonna pay, make sure that there was a judgment for
right.
for my client, but they didn't want it to be unfair in their mind to the 16-year-old girl because they really liked her. I mean, it was clear she testified well, she was a likable person, but she really hurt my client. So they asked it once, we said we can't give that to you. So then they deliberated some more and then kind of came back and asked sort of a backdoor question, trying to get the sense of what assets were or anything else. Again, trying to get to a sense of
right.
what's the 16-year-old girl going to be saddled with when we make this verdict. And in the end, they made a guess on what her policy limits were. And they gave the maximum that they thought they could in those policy limits. Well, it turned out in our case that the 16-year-old had pretty minimal limits, and then my client had underinsured uninsured motorist coverage for another $1 million. So they could have made a verdict for almost anything, and it would have been covered. Well, in the end, the verdict that they made didn't get to my client's UM/UIM coverage. And then my client was stuck because she couldn't relitigate that UM/UIM claim because she'd already provided that information to the jurors
right.
and they came back with a limit that was less than what it should have been. So those are examples of where that whole motion and limine practice mm-hmm. Makes a difference. And in that case, I couldn't do anything about it. It is, the law is what it is.
Sure.
And it's there for a good reason, except in my case, this particular example that I'm giving, it was sort of backfired on my client. But there wasn't anything that we could do about it mm-hmm. because the court had made its ruling and it is what it is. But those are the sorts of things. And in criminal cases, we have all kinds of issues that come up from time to time relating to either what the prosecution has done in the way of what they've provided us for evidence or potentially, you know, what we can raise in the way of criminal histories relating to particular individuals that may testify, whether they're felonies, how old those felonies are, whether it's related to what I'll call moral torpitude or the fact that they may lie while they're on the stand. And you really, in those final motions issues are really trying to define how exactly the evidence is going to be presented to the jury so that everybody knows what's going to be done so that you can do the best you can in making the spin that you need in the way of either prosecuting the case or defending it.
Right. And you know, it goes back to our point, which we say all the time, just listening to you go through this, this is why you want to make sure you have an attorney that's experienced with the court system.
Yeah.
You know, the way trials work, all that. Because, man, I would hate to have somebody that has no clue
yeah, and
representing me.
Yep, absolutely. And I see it pretty regularly. I mean, it is a practice of law because that's you do practice in doing
sure.
trials. You can't do trials in a vacuum. You just can't because there's so many variables relating to human beings and how they may testify or how people react to questions. You know, the whole interesting part of the jury system is just one part of it is the jury selection process and how you get people to talk and how you get a relationship with 15 or 20 people in the span of 15 mm-hmm. or 20 minutes
sure.
so that you can come to what you hope is a credible belief about what they may or may not do when they decide the case.
Right.
I mean, it's really hard and it's something that you have to do time and time again and make mistakes along the way to finally get a theory about how it really works and how you best serve your client. That's just not done mm-hmm. without doing it.
Yeah,
you
no
know.
Doubt.
And so but it's a really interesting part of the process. Then there's lots of trial lawyers, good trial lawyers, that don't really like that particular process in the trial. The whole, it's just a surprising. When you get to talk to community members that are uncomfortable in the position that they're in because most people have never done it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in most jury panels, I'll have, so out of, let's say, 25 people, normal civil panel, I'll maybe have 4 or 5 people that had previously served, and half of those probably have only gotten to the stage that they're at now where they're questioned and then they're released.
Yeah.
And so you send 6 people off to a room by themselves, give them some basic instructions and say, well, you figure it out. You figure out how you guys are going to come to a conclusion on this. And that's what you're trying to do. I'm trying to educate them through the process, you know, give them perspective from what my client is doing and why we're bringing the case, and then asking them to give them a judgment, asking them to pay them money, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard process to go through. Most people don't want to do it. It's understandable why they wouldn't want to do it.
Right.
And what you're really trying to get them is engaged and participate in the trial enough that when they go back in that room, they do care to make a decision. Because both parties in mm-hmm. these sorts of things care about what the jury does. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, going back to our TV courtrooms, you see where, you know, someone's getting cross-examined and the other attorney jumps up and, you know, objects and all that. Does that happen a lot in a lot of different...
So it's every trial's a little different. This last trial I did, I was trying the case. The defense had two experienced trial lawyers. I think in 4 days of testimony, one day we had 10 witnesses. On Tuesday we examined 10 witnesses. We probably had 5 objections for probably 25 witnesses. That's pretty good. In cases where I do, let's say a misdemeanor case, I have a one-day trial with a trial lawyer that is not very experienced and doesn't understand sort of how you can get evidence in appropriately, I may have 30 objections. And I may, in those cases, because the lawyer just doesn't understand it, I've had this happen multiple times in the last 6-8 months, the lawyer doesn't, I object on the basis in which they're asking a question. Maybe I know the response is going to be hearsay, so my objection is hearsay. There's no exception. The lawyer doesn't know how to get around that by asking a different question or attempt to do something, and they get frustrated and they just move on to another topic.
Which happens. Is what you want.
That's what I want, yeah. Yes. Because a lot of times the things that I'm really objecting to are exactly the crux of the issues relating to the what our theory of defense is mm-hmm. or what the prosecution needs in the way of evidence. And if they can't get it in through a particular witness and they haven't thought about it significantly enough to have another witness testify about it, because a lot of times you can fix this stuff by having somebody else that's maybe closer to the document or maybe is more involved in the case that can talk about it and give their perceptions of something versus relying on somebody's word, because somebody's word generally doesn't come into court unless mm-hmm. they're testifying in person, and so especially in the criminal cases. And so the objection practice in trial has to be very carefully done, just right. because jurors don't want to hear you getting up and sure. arguing all the time. You just look like sort of an argumentative ass at that point, right? And they hold it against your client. But where the objections are of benefit in the sense that they recognize that you're really trying to make sure that the best evidence is provided to them and the court in a particular manner, and the court is agreeing with you, then they generally understand that then there's probably something wrong with the other lawyer and what they're doing the way they're
asking. Are there times where maybe, you know, when I say you, an attorney may say something knowing the other attorney is going to object, but they still got that statement out there where the jurors could hear it?
So, so those are speaking objections. So a lot of times now the courts won't allow you to do a speaking objection. So the best example is, you know, maybe the prosecution it's a domestic violence case. And you make an objection and you want to make sure that the person doesn't make the statement. But the way that you make the objection, the reason that you're making the objection is because exactly what you want the jurors to think, maybe just the opposite. And so your objection is that, and you add that extra detail to give the court some pause as to why you're objecting. That sort of discussion with the court isn't evidence, but at the same time, the jurors can't really unhear it.
Yeah,
right.
That's what
so
I mean.
you put it in front of them. Yeah,
right.
We also see it in jury selection. The last jury I had, one of the jurors was a lawyer that practiced in this jurisdiction, and he had practiced for 30 years and done a bunch of plaintiffs' civil work and defense civil work, and you could tell he was being very careful not to say, "I think this insurance company is ridiculous in what they're doing in this case or in most cases." Mm-hmm. But he was very close to that. And so what we did is we pulled him out of the jury box and we had a conversation with him outside the other jurors, because if he had made the statements that he was about to make, it would have tainted the whole panel. And it would have hurt the whole panel in the sense that most likely they would have gotten information from him that would have helped my client but been unfair to the defense. And so it's those sorts of things that's why the judges generally don't want you to do a speaking objection. And in the event that you have specific facts or things that you need to bring up to the court, they'll ask you to come forward to by the bench, mm-hmm. and then you'll have a conversation at the bench away from the jurors' hearing. And you see that in court all the time,
right?
Where the judge will say, "Come up," you know.
That
and the parties
was actually my next question.
Yeah,
does that happen much? And what are the usually term where you know like
it's a bench conference.
You're just objecting, and maybe he's getting tired of it, and he just wants you guys to get it figured out.
Sure. Well, 15 years ago, I had a trial. It was a theft charge in which the prosecution wasn't getting to what the actual theft was. And we had picked a jury. We were about a halfway through the prosecution's case. And I had objected to something. And the judge looked at both of us and said, "Come up to the bench. I want to have a conference." So mm-hmm. we walk up to the bench. And now they put on white noise so the jurors can't hear you and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So we're standing next to the three of us, standing very close. The judge is on the bench, sitting in his chair, and we're standing. And the benches are pretty high. So, you know, you just basically have your head over the bench. So we're having the conversation, and he ruled on the objection that I had, and he sustained the objection. And then he said to the prosecutor, "Are we going to get to the theft today? Like, move this along."
Right.
Well, in that particular case, the judge was giving the message to the prosecutor, "Listen, I'm not going to tolerate this much longer. Mm-hmm. Either put the evidence on or we're going to get out of here." And in that particular case, DA never got to the theft, and the judge dismissed the case at halftime.
Right.
So the jury didn't even have to make a decision. But those things happen at bench conferences where the parties are having discussions that you don't want the jury to hear, but they may be really important discussions. And if they're going to be extended periods of time, then you'll ask the jurors to go out back into the jury room, and then you'll have a conversation in the regular courtroom without the jurors there so that the judge can make a decision. And that happens quite frequently,
sure,
too.
Sure. Well, a lot to know here. Boy, a couple of areas we didn't get to touch on, the sentencing phase of this and maybe appeals and all that. So maybe we'll try to pick that up the next week.
Sure.
But, Kevin, I mean, it does take a an experienced attorney to get somebody through this. And I think, you know, one thing, again, we hear over and over all these years we've been doing this is clients just say, "Man, you know, it's a heavy burden when they walk through your door." And when they walk out, I mean, they just automatically feel better because they just said, you know, of your experience and the way you took control.
Yeah, I mean, we're really honest about when people come in and talk to us about these cases and what we think and what our experience is, and that really helps people. I mean, that's part of the counselor at law as well. We're really helping them so that they get rid of the unknown, so that we can explain what takes place and how it'll work and what it is that they can do to better themselves in the situation. Because most of the times, it's a no-win situation, right? We're just trying to make the best of a bad deal. And so we're getting them through that. But that alone is helpful for them. And it's that sort of practice where we add the value and we help them with it that really makes a difference.
Yeah. Kevin, always great information. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Legal Talk, brought to you by Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. I want to thank you for being with us. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Don't go anywhere. Functional Medicine with Dan Muir and Dr. Ben coming up next.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
Can you believe how low rates are staying? Still in the twos. Back in the 40s and the 50s, rates were in the 5-6% range. How much longer are you going to wait? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Your home has never been worth more. Take AIM to get that lower rate or shorten your term. Lower your payment and pay thousands less in interest. It's your money. Call 720-895-0500 now. Affordable Interest Mortgage. Locally owned and family operated since 2001. Are you ready for the future financially? Many of our clients have the ability to access their equity for 30 years without raising their payments now. This prepares them for those speed bumps of life. Ask how you can become mortgage safe too. Take AIM, 720-895-0500, where a reputation of putting you first and listening to you is unmatched in Colorado. Call 720-895-0500 now so you can focus on what's important, family. Regulated by DOR, NMLS 298-191, Equal Credit Lender.
You're listening to AM 560, KLZ, your home station.
It's time for the Functional Medicine Show with Dr. Ben, brought to you by the Functional Medicine Center of Fort Collins. Dr. Ben is committed to helping patients find the root cause of their health problems. Increase your vitality to live your fullest life without drugs and surgery. Now, here's your host, Dan Muir.
And I'm not Dan Muir. I'm actually John Rush, host of Rush to Reason, Drive Radio, Fix It Radio as well. I've been on before, though, with Dr. Ben. So, Dr. Ben, welcome. How are you, sir?
Oh, doing great. I usually go outside during my call and pace it. My team says I pace while I'm doing the call. But it's like 100 degrees out there.
It's a little toasty today, Dr. Ben. It is. And by the way, when Dan asked if I could fill in for him today with you, it was actually on, and I'm not joking because you're with me. It was an automatic yes. I had a ball the last couple of times I've done this with you. I always learn something whether I'm listening to the program or I'm hosting it like I am today. So I was excited, and I've been looking forward to talking to you, Dr. Ben.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you jumping on and keeping us flowing today.
No, it's been great. Okay, so first off, and this is something that I know if I have to ask it, and I know a little bit about what you do, and I've interviewed you before, but I still don't know everything. So explain to us right off the bat, what is functional medicine?
Absolutely. So sometimes we'll come in and say, what is it not? And what is functional medicine not? Functional medicine is not, oh, take this one thing because you're having that one symptom. And that's called a this for that model. And whether that's even a medication, like I had a gentleman come over yesterday from Kimball, Nebraska, and he was on like 15 different medications. And he's like, oh, well, that gave me that one for that thing, and they gave me that one for that thing, and then my blood pressure went up because of that, and so then I took this other one, and, you know, it's just one drug after another. But what a lot of people get into is they actually do that on the natural side as well. And so some of you out there may be this person where you look in your cabinet or your spouse's cabinet, it's like, holy cow, you got all these vitamins and herbs and supplements and Shaklee or whatever you're taking, and it's just, oh, I can't sleep, take that melatonin. I can't go to the bathroom, take that magnesium. And so you just take a this for that, but it's from the natural side. So that is what functional medicine is not, and especially true functional medicine like we practice, where we truly want to get to that underlying why. Why is the body going haywire? So I had a gentleman yesterday, 41 years old. 2 years ago, he got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Right. You know what that is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so that's autoimmune. Most of the time, you hear that about kids, right?
Right.
You know, the kid gets diagnosed and they have to get their pump and they're checking their blood sugar and all that stuff. But this guy got it when he was 39 years old.
Right.
And
wow.
Why? And so you think about it. Well, that's an autoimmune condition, and so the body's going haywire. Just like my mom developed MS. My wife had thrombocytopenia, as autoimmune to the platelets. We can get all different types of autoimmune conditions, but that's just when his body decided to go haywire, and that's the system that it started to attack. And so instead of just saying, oh, we're going to try to stabilize your blood sugar, we looked at everything else. We looked at other autoimmune markers, and there was one for what's called Hashimoto's, autoimmune thyroid as well. And so not only did his body attack his pancreas, but it's also attacking the thyroid. And so then we went through and we looked at blood sugar and we looked at liver and gut and all these different systems, and that's what we're going to be working on with him. Okay. We're not going to be going, ooh, take this cinnamon and that's going to help your blood sugar. That's the farthest thing from what we need to be doing. We need to be down-regulating this immune inflammatory cascade, and that's what most everybody out there listening has, is some type of inflammation in their body. But it comes out different ways. I got a patient, just talked to him on Tuesday. He's down south of Denver, close to Colorado Springs. He's down 110 pounds in the last 7 months.
Wow.
He went from full-blown diabetes, 7.2 A1C down to 5.4, no more fatty liver, all these things. But even with him, it wasn't this magic supplement that we did it. We just went through step by step, figured out what he was eating that was wrong, figured out what system was out of balance, repaired those, okay. And his body said, sweet, I can drop 110 pounds.
Now, I know you guys have got a location in Fort Collins plus another couple locations. Talk about those real quick so everybody listening knows exactly where to go and give them a phone number.
Yeah, absolutely. So we also have an office in Phoenix. It's been there for about the past year and going great, great team down there, really helping a lot of people. We're actually getting ready to open up a second office in the Scottsdale area there.
Nice.
And then we just recently opened in Brentwood, which is kind of the Cherry Creek part of Nashville.
Okay.
And having a great time there, really making some changes in lives already, and we'll be expanding to a second Nashville location as well. So
nice.
our vision is to get this model out to the masses, as many people as possibly can that are dealing with all of these issues and just aren't getting the results that they want and need. And so our phone number, 970-282-1173, and you'll speak with Alicia. Alicia does a great job making sure that you're a good fit, that what you have going on, we're going to be able to help, but also making sure that somebody is ready and willing and wants to put the time and energy in, because it is an energy intensive thing.
What you're telling me is I get out of it what I put into it.
Absolutely. You know, it's when you're changing out that alternator like my buddy was
right
on his 7.3 liter excursion over the weekend. You know, he put in a couple busted knuckles on there and everything, but guess what? It's up and it's up and running.
Yep.
He didn't just look at it long enough and hope for it to work.
You know, Dr. Ben, I know we want to talk about, you know, energy and sleep and thyroid and things along those lines today, but, you know, the one thing I always learned in radio is if I personally have a question, most likely, you know, as a host, there's lots of people listening that probably have a similar question. And I know this is going to sound really dumb. I've got family members that even have, you know, autoimmune issues and some things like that going on. But I will tell you, when it comes to that particular word, I'm not sure that I fully understand what you and others mean when they say they have an autoimmune disorder. Can you explain what those actually are and maybe even some of the symptoms of, so people kind of know what we're talking about? Because if I don't know, I guarantee you there's people listening that don't either.
Absolutely. And I explain it every day to patients. And, you know, some people, they've watched all my videos. And for those that have not seen my Facebook page, check out Functional Medicine Center Fort Collins. Over 400 or 500 videos on there. We're up almost 50,000 followers on our Facebook pages.
Nice.
Lots of great information on there, and I go live multiple times a week and just really try to offer a lot of information. So I do have videos on there, so if you want more information, also if you're not on Facebook, our YouTube page has a lot of that as well. But think about it this way. So there's 190 named autoimmune conditions in this world that we're aware of.
Okay.
That means names. Some of them we don't even know about. 8-to-1 ratio female to male. So a lot more women have autoimmune conditions than male. Not fair. Sorry, women.
Why is that, Dr. Ben?
One of the biggest reasons is that it has an estrogenic event can really drive autoimmune conditions. I see many women, if they come in and say, I was never the same after that second kid or third kid or first kid or whatever. First thought, autoimmune. Their body went haywire. Last year, I found three teenage girls that had Hashimoto's, autoimmune thyroid. What was that? Well, going through puberty. That's an estrogenic event. So that's a big part of it.
Okay.
Another thing, you know, us guys, not always going to the doctor. You know, we'll rub some grease on it.
Sure,
some Windex or whatever. And so, you know, one is that there's just, you know, women are more likely to take care of themselves, but the other is that unfortunately their bodies, you know, they have to go through pregnancies and menstrual changes every month and all.
Yeah, they go through things that we just don't go through as men, right?
Absolutely. So here's what we're looking at. 190 named autoimmune conditions, third leading cause of death in the U.S. when you lump them all together.
Wow.
And people say, well, why would you lump them together? Well, it's a very similar underlying issue. If one person has an autoimmune condition, they are very likely to have multiple autoimmune conditions, meaning they're like the gentleman yesterday, type 1 diabetes, but he also had Hashimoto's, which is autoimmune thyroid, but I'll see that all the time. Somebody comes in with Hashimoto's, and they also have lupus markers and all these different things. So the body is going haywire, and it's deciding to attack its own tissue. So you've heard of a COVID antibody test, right?
Right.
So somebody comes in and go, oh, I think I had COVID. I'd like to know, you know, should I get the vaccine or not? If I have COVID and the antibodies, I may not have to do that or whatever their rationale is. They want to see if they had COVID. And an antibody is a cell that's produced by the body when a virus, bacteria, pathogen comes in. So if we tested you right now for chickenpox antibodies, you would still have those because you had that virus, your body created these antibodies,
okay.
And then it sent immune system cells to attack that. Did you ever see 13 Strong?
Yes.
On the horses,
right.
And you know, all that. So for those of you out there that haven't, great movie, patriotic, you know, 4th
yes.
of July, great,
yes.
great theme for the week. But it was after 9/11, and they sent these Navy SEALs and in basically to Afghanistan, and were up on these ridges, and they were riding horseback through with their full auto guns, all this stuff. But they would pinpoint exactly where those B-52s should bomb or where the drones should strike or whatever. And so they were the antibodies, and they were pointing down and saying, okay, bomb
okay.
here.
Okay.
So antibodies don't do the attacking, but they target the tissue. So when we have antibodies to the thyroid, that means the body is attacking the thyroid. When we have antibodies to the pancreas, that means the body is attacking the pancreas and going to get type 1 diabetes. Or my mom's case, her nerves and her MS, or my wife's case, her platelets. So all of those things are going to be triggered by certain things in the body. And that's where we really get into with functional medicine, is why is this happening? Because traditional medical model looks at autoimmune and says, oh, let's suppress it. Let's suppress that immune system, give you prednisone, give you methotrexate, low-dose chemo, Humira, $10,000 a month drugs that you see on TV, and then they've got that list of 40 different side effects that you might die or whatever else is going on. And instead, we say, let's take a step back. Why on earth would the body want to attack its own tissue? I mean, that's just crazy, right? You know, like, that's when we self-destruct, and that's the end of things. And so instead, just like my mom healed from her MS, and she's 78 years old, does granny boot camp and runs around fishing with my kids, all kinds of stuff, she healed from MS. She doesn't have plaquing on her MRI anymore. Why? Because her body decided, hey, I don't have to be this revved up. I don't have to be creating this inflammatory cascade that is triggering an attack in my body. And so what are we going to do? Well, we're going to calm down. We're going to let the body heal. And that's how people reverse their rheumatoid arthritis, their lupus, their MS, all these different conditions, because it is stimulated by something. We don't want to just suppress it. We want to stop the body, whatever is causing that stimulation in the first place.
Okay. Makes total sense. Great, great explanation. Now, the thing that I'm guessing, because I'm not a doctor, but I'm guessing just from everything you just said, getting to the bottom, if you would, of what those are, I'm guessing, Dr. Ben, can be very difficult and is most likely a process, not a one-time fix.
Absolutely. And on my videos that I talk about autoimmune all the time on, I'll draw a circle and then a whole bunch of other circles coming out of it. And it's a multifaceted approach. So I've got this this thistle issue in my yard. You ever
yep.
picking a thistle?
Yep.
Yeah. And how many roots are coming off that thistle usually?
Far too many. Let's just say that.
but far too many. But there's one main one, right? You pull it out, and you're like, holy cow, that thing's like...
And that's if you can get all of it, yes.
Right, yeah, you're not going to be able to get it. But if you can, it's like 2 feet long, and then
right.
the thistle's only 3 inches tall. So a lot of people, they think about, ooh, functional medicine, alternative medicine, natural medicine, get to the root cause. And I don't think this is the right grammar, but it's more of the roots cause. And that's probably not right, but
it makes sense.
You pull out the oak tree and you pull it out by the roots and all of this dirt and everything comes out and you're like, wow, there's a lot of roots and they're going all different directions and some of them are crisscrossing each other and some of them are touching each other and we're supporting each other up and all these things. And that is how our true functional medicine model really, really helps bodies heal. We don't fix anybody. I've never healed anybody. I'm not that kind of a doctor.
Right.
You know, we enable the body to do what it's supposed to do. And we take out the bad stuff, put in the good stuff. And that might be lady this morning, 8 different systems. She had a lot going on and she's 42 years old, recent divorce, all this stress, all these things. She's still functioning. She's working night job and doing, you know, medical stuff and all these things. But, you know, she is not optimal, and we know what's coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. And we know, yeah, it could be autoimmune. Mm-hmm. It could be a diabetes. It could be a inflammatory process that could cause a lot of other issues. So we don't know what it's going to be, but we know what's coming down the pike is not going to be constructive long term.
Okay. Again, folks, we're talking to Dr. Ben. I'm your host, John Rush. The phone number, 970-282-1173, up in Fort Collins. There's other locations around the country as well. Go to fmcenters.com to find out more information. So, Dr. Ben, let's go ahead and talk about, shift gears and talk about, you know, afternoon energy, thyroid, sleep patterns. I'm assuming that, and I just know this, you know, personally, that having all of those things in sync, you know, getting the right amount of sleep, having the right amount of energy, you know, doing the things necessary to really stay, you know, get on and stay on track. There's no magic bullet. This is a process, right?
Absolutely. So if everybody listening was in a classroom and I said, raise your hand if you have afternoon slump, if you have afternoon energy drop, anything like that, probably 75% of the people would raise their hand.
Right.
And they're doing things to try to compensate for that. So what are some of those things we see now? Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of folks are doing things from coffee to stimulants to energy drinks to whatever. And I, by the way, as somebody that has an afternoon talk show, and I've got to really be ramped up and ready to go by about 2 p.m, which is probably when Dr. Ben, a lot of other folks are starting that, you know, kind of downhill slump, if you would. I don't have that opportunity to ever have that. I have to do every single thing I possibly can to not have those afternoon slumps. And you're right. You know, myself included, if, you know, sometimes, and I'm not an energy drink guy, but, you know, occasionally a cup of coffee or a little bit of caffeine some way, somehow, you know, it's a stimulant that will kind of help you get over that. But I do my best to not do that very often.
Absolutely. And crazy, crazy numbers out there. People under 18, 75% of them are drinking energy drinks on a regular basis. I was just blown away.
And those things, just for everybody listening, and this I know for a fact, Dr. Ben, they are not good for you.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
And yet they, you know, they throw them around like they're candy. And it's, you know, then you combine that with Ritalin and some of these other meds that kids are on and all kinds of stuff. And it's a nightmare. But
okay, I want to stop you for a second real quick on the energy drink side of the fence, because I'm assuming that they're sort of like a lot of other things in life. Just because they're there doesn't mean they're necessarily bad, but they can be abused and be bad. And I guess my point is, you know, is it ever okay, long trip, or you do need a little bit of a stimulant? I mean, is there anything wrong with having one on an occasion? I'm not that guy because I just don't like the taste or anything else of them. But for people listening, you know, is one ever bad? Or, I mean, is it just one of those things you should just always stay away from no matter what, period?
Yeah, so one is not going to give somebody a heart attack. One is not going to make you overweight or obese or things like that. Just like a cup of coffee
is not going to wreck your adrenal glands and cause you to crash and all those things. But it's just like anything. If you have one cigarette, are you going to get lung cancer? No.
Okay.
If you have one glass of wine, are you going to get fatty liver? Are you going to turn into an alcoholic? No. If you do some meth, one thing of meth, maybe you'll get hooked.
Maybe.
Don't do meth.
Right.
But you're talking about there, though,
and I'm glad you said that, because the way I understand it, and again, I'm not an energy drink, you know, guy, but with the way I understand it, Dr. Ben, they can be very habit forming, much like some of the other things you just mentioned. Am I right?
Absolutely. Why do people smoke weed before bed? Why do people drink three or four glasses of wine when they get home and they're cooking dinner and all that? Because they're changing their state. Why does somebody drink coffee in the morning? Well, some people just because they love the flavor, but most people because they're trying to change their state.
Right.
And so I want people to do something because they want to or because they like the taste, whatever, but not because they have to, not because they need to change that state.
Okay.
So here's some of the things that we're looking at. I did a video on this yesterday on the top five things that you can do to keep that all afternoon energy just going throughout the day. I did my video at like 6:30 in the evening last night, and I still had the same amount of energy that I did at 7:30 in the morning when I got to the office. And the reason was because I'm doing these things. So one of the first things that you do is you get up and you actually do your exercise, you do your activity, your movement in the morning. So get up, get moving. That tells the brain and the body that, hey, this is going to be some kind of a day that we got to get ourselves going, get some blood flow going, get some energy going. That metabolism, it kicks in your thyroid, body fat burning, all those things. So for me, I jump on the treadmill. I used to sit down while I wrote and journaled and prayed and read the Bible and everything else. But now I'm like, well, why would I sit extra? Because that's actually going to be another thing I'm going to talk about. So I get on the treadmill. I'm on there for 45 minutes. I'm riding. I'm doing all these things, and then I'll do my workout after that. And so it's a get up and go type of a thing where you've got to get that body movement moving. But just to crawl out of bed, you know, sit on the kitchen table chair there and drink your coffee and just like, oh, I can't do this. You know, it's going to be hard to have that all day energy in there. So then another thing that we talk about doing, just like I said on my treadmill, I don't sit anymore. Stand at work. So if you're in a cubicle setting, if you're at a desk job, and if you're at home and you have to work from home now, any of those things, make it so that you can stand various times throughout the day. Get it to a point where you're standing most of the time. When I'm on Zoom calls or doing things with patients that they're not in office, I'm standing. I'm figured out I can kind of march in place without my head even moving, and it doesn't look like I'm marching in place. And so you've got to stand. You've got to get that blood flowing. They say that sitting is actually worse than smoking and a lot of other things for health, sitting all day. So, you know, get up and move, and that's going to be huge. One of the things that, you know, on these days when I do these calls, I always say you've got to shut it down for lunch, and you've got to give your brain a chance to rest, to recuperate a little bit. Most people work through lunch. They sit at their desk.
Right.
They're just doom scrolling on their phone. They're trying to catch up on emails, whatever it is. But take time, go outside, breathe, you know, whether that's go for a little walk, sit and look at the clouds going by, whatever you can do, you've got to separate yourself from whatever it is. Otherwise, you're going to be really likely to crash in that afternoon. We get back to the stimulants. The time to avoid the stimulants is actually in the morning. So most people, like if I have a cup of coffee in the morning, I'm yawning in the afternoon. Maybe I'm not crashing, but I'm yawning. I can tell the difference. And we've seen that in patients over and over and over again. So we get this little spike, and then mid-afternoon we start crashing down. So that's a big part of it, is wean yourself off, work off of those stimulants in the morning, and maybe a cup of coffee on the weekend or whatever is fine. But if you're doing three or four cups of coffee a morning or Red Bulls or whatever it is, you are going to be setting yourself up for an afternoon crash. So work your way off, figure out why you need those stimulants in the first place. Is it which system is out of balance, adrenals or gut or liver or whatever else it is? Fix those so that you don't need those stimulants. Another thing that we look at is blood sugar. So this is a huge one for so many people. It's why I wrote my book a couple of years ago, Blood Sugar Doesn't Lie. You can get that on Amazon. And in Blood Sugar Doesn't Lie, I talk all about why that blood sugar goes up and why it goes down, but the symptoms that people are having. So if that blood sugar is crashing, let's say somebody has a sandwich or a burrito or whatever it is for lunch, that blood sugar is probably going to go down in the next couple hours. And what does that feel like?
Makes sense. Makes total sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the tired, spacey, hangry. Hangry.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, everything you're saying makes total sense. I luckily am one of those where I drink coffee in the morning just because I like the taste. I don't have to have it to get up, get going. I mean, just I'm weird. I know. I'm just one of those guys that is pretty much going all the time like you. It doesn't matter whether it's 6 in the morning or 6 at night. That's just kind of, you know, who I am. But I do know the blood sugar end of things, it's huge. And I also have learned through the things that I've even done on my other programs and so on that sugar is not our friend.
Absolutely not. As opposed to, you know, Time Magazine and a lot of these publications and TV shows and everything that have been paid off to go, oh, sugar, the miracle, you know, additive or whatever.
No, it's
not. I mean, it's, at some point, it could be class action lawsuits like tobacco and some of those. I mean, it's, I always say, if we could stabilize everybody's blood sugar like we do with our patients, get it to be in the good range that we want it to be, we would reverse and prevent 90% of chronic conditions from Alzheimer's, diabetes, and cancers, and strokes, and obesity, all these different things. You know, it can be as simple as that.
Wow. That is amazing. I know we've got about a minute left is all, Dr. Ben. And for those of you listening, again, location up in Fort Collins, for those of you up and down the Front Range area listening to us now, there's other locations around the country. You can find that at the website. It's fmcenters.com or call 970-282-1173. Dr. Ben, got about a minute left is all. What do you want to end up with? What do you want to, how do you want to close out, sir?
Yeah, so just had some patients come up from Aurora this morning, and I was joking with them because we get probably 60% of our patients from out of state. I had a lady from Louisiana last week, from Los Angeles, Montana. They come down from Casper, North Platte, all over the place. And I say, we're more likely to get a patient from Casper or North Platte that's going to drive 4 hours to come see us than somebody from Denver.
Amazing.
You know, nobody wants to drive to traffic and everything.
Right.
But here's the deal. You come up once, you see us, and just like the patient from down by Colorado Springs that lost 110 pounds, I've seen him once in person. I had to have him stand up on Zoom, show me how loose his pants were, show me how loose his shirt was, because I hadn't seen him in 6.5 months. And yet we were able to do all of those things remotely. And so no matter where you are, no matter where you live, what your situation is, give us a call, 970-282-1173. Check out fmcenters.com and see if you're a good fit. And if we can help you, we'll let you know that and then move forward with getting you your life back.
Folks, I can tell you real quick, I know we just have a few seconds left here, Dr. Ben, but you cannot put a price on health. You can't put a price on feeling good. Folks, this is an investment. It really is. I know this just from what I do, again, and all the other programs I do and the things we talk about on a routine basis. Dr. Ben, again, as I said earlier, I really was looking forward to talking to you today. I always learn something when I'm with you. I'll do this anytime. Anytime you guys need me, just holler and I'll be here. And I appreciate it very much. It's been a joy being with you today, sir.
Absolutely. Thanks for filling in. Everybody, be well out there.
All right, Dr. Ben, that is the Functional Medicine Centers.
Thank you for joining us for the Functional Medicine Show with Dr. Ben. Contact the Functional Medicine Center of Fort Collins now by visiting functionalmedicinefortcollins.com or call 970-716-0079. Join Dan Muir and Dr. Ben next time right here on KLZ.
The health advice and opinions on this broadcast are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent the views of this station, Crawford Broadcasting Company, its staff, management, or sponsors.